The Institute on Religious Life and the Daughters of St. Mary of Providence of Chicago bring you this fourth and last tape on a lecture given by Father John A. Hardin, S.J., entitled The Rise and Growth of Western Monasticism. Father Hardin.
What monasticism did, and this is its first great contribution to religious, just as within a diocese the people are responsible to the bishop for the government of that diocese and for their obedience to his laws, so in a religious community. Now, originally, for example, say Monte Cassino, that would be a territory. What Saint Benedict conceived, and this is his first great contribution, he modeled religious life on the church's own pattern of territorial division. Our provinces, our regions, are an offshoot of that. Now you might say, well, you would almost want to do that for the reasons of efficiency. Not so. It's much deeper than efficiency, because the bond, no less than between one of the faithful to the bishop, so between a religious, say to the abbot, that everybody within a certain territory is responsible to this one person for his or her, well, sanctification and effective apostolate. The result was that even when communities like the Society of Jesus or any other Benedictines here besides yourself, sister? Well, we've got one Benedictine. But even as other communities came into existence, the basic principle of centrality was retained. So that no matter where you go, you are always attached somehow to a person. You follow the idea? And when I say step out of my province, I belong, if you please, to the Detroit province, and I'm living in the New York province, and I'm now teaching in the Chicago province. But in each case, the jurisdiction is not merely, you might say, legalism. I must get permission to do whatever I'm doing, not only from my own provincial, but from the provincial in the territory where I work. Secondly, community. Well, the monastic tradition contributed to religious was the idea of a community that, as we saw from the church's early history, was first and mainly a group of believers. It was first of all a community of faith. Secondly, it was a community of obedience. And thirdly, it was a community of service. But what bears emphasis is that the communal character of religious life depended not only on, say, being obedient to the abbot. The community is also interrelated, so that my bond to my community is not only that, say, 50 in a given community all have the same superior and each going their respective ways. You will still have a community in name, but no longer in reality. We call that a corporate apostolate, for example. Corporate living. We must share. Living together, being together, working together, recreating together. Now, where everything is done together, that's monasticism, pure and simple. Okay? One of the features of community life in the strictly monastic tradition is that everything is done together. Even, for example, mental prayer in the strictly monastic tradition, you did not, for example, go into chapel by yourself and pray, or in the quiet of your room. It was done together. Third, the monastic tradition created what we now call the constitutions of communities. As we know, the early monastic structures, Pachomius, Antony, and later on Benedict, did not have what we call constitutions. Constitutions, of course, do not originally belong to the first monastic communities. They had a rule of life where basically it was the rule plus the abbot. However, the ground was laid for eventual constitutions, and mainly because, well, other reasons too, that the rules tended to remain fixed and times change, needless to say. The abbot, well, he would change all right, because he was elected for life, but so much, in fact, it was felt sometimes too much dependent on just the abbot. So both because of the changing times and because an abbot could be quite arbitrary, constitutions eventually came into existence, but there would have been no thought of constitutions eventually unless they had first been the rule written and the abbot, of course, the living rule. Fourth contribution, the divine office. Even to use a word like divine office, the office, remember, I have a little office upstairs on the fourth floor at the university, number 36, and well, it's an office all right, but by office we mean duty. And it's a divine office, which means a divinely authorized or binding duty. Whereas, remember, we developed this at some length, where the divine office, the hours of the office, became, you might say, the fabric for the whole day. Everything had to be adjusted to the liturgy of the hours. And finally, the rules. The rules that we now have, which are independent of the constitutions, are a further development from the monastic tradition, which were generally more specific prescriptions for either certain persons holding a certain office or for certain duties in the community. For the priests, what's the contribution of a monastic tradition to priests? The monastic tradition really created the diocesan community. We don't know, because we're guessing, what the Catholic Church today would be like, except that from the very beginning, there were religious in the Catholic Church. So that it was a very short time of the second century already. The bishop then became, in the nature of a father to his priests, and even where is in most cases today in the Catholic Church, most priests are not religious. Nevertheless, the relationship of bishop to priests and priests to their bishop is patterned on the monastic model. And this is where, because I deal a great deal with diocesan priests, I really believe that once religious life weakens, as it has drastically weakened in our age, I hope you've been told religious life today needs drastic reformation. From the bottom up, or for some communities, from the top down. But the church suffers, especially among the priests, where they do not have the pattern of religious. This is men identifying with men who are living the kind of lives they should. To this day, most of the books in theology, most of the books in morality, most of the writings in the ascetical life, the spiritual life, are written by religious priests. Their ideas and ideals affect the diocesan priesthood more than I think, unless you were a priest yourself, you would appreciate. In any case, the diocesan community, with all the relationships between bishop and priests, depends very much on religious and originally on the monastic tradition. Secondly, and this I'd like to say, well, I don't know exactly what I would say if there were diocesan priests in the class. Ideally, a religious priest is meant to have the best of both worlds. All I can tell you is the combination is very difficult to maintain in practice. We'll talk about this in a few minutes. Now for the laity. What is the first and most important contribution of the monastic way of life to the laity? It is the idea of living a regulated life. I cannot tell you how important that is for our faithful today. And whatever counseling or advice you may give, whether professionally or even informally, even members of your own family, anything you can do to help the laity live a more regular life. I hope you appreciate what I'm saying. It's the irregularity that can be so disastrous to, you know, progress and virtue. So that certain things are done in a certain way at a certain time. Part of that is periodicity. By periodicity, I mean the laity. Now, don't let them tell you I'm not a monk or a nun. That's right, you're not. But you want to live a balanced, healthy, and happy life? Of course. Regularity in food. Nobody has to tell me I'm not a monk, because this is one thing that I often find very difficult, but I know it's not good, not even good for the body. So regularity in the sleep, the hours of sleep, the circumstances in which a person does this. I have a special time when I pray, and I know what prayer I say. And this should be taught. I don't mean you're going to go into all of this and reflectively explain it to the youngsters in first or second grade. But some of this regularity and periodicity we need in our chaotic American culture. So the laity need us. Secular institutes, I want to close with this, are of course not religious, nor are they laity, but I know enough of them, I've been counseling them, to know it's extremely difficult for them to live, as they try to, their vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, but outside of a community. That's almost a good, simple definition of a secular institute. They are religious cults without a community. And the need for some regularity, but also communal life, are both contributions of monasticism to the laity as well. The laity need community life. By the way, I think I memorized it. Yes, I did. I was waiting till 1:30 in the Amtrak station this morning to get the train in Pittsburgh. And I did a lot of homework. I prepared my class for today here. But, you know, 12:10, 12:15, you don't feel too, you know, hep anymore. I was strongly tempted to go to sleep, but I thought to myself, who will wake me up? And besides, I didn't think a priest should be, you know, lying sprawled on a bench in the Grand Central Station of Pittsburgh. So to keep myself awake, I bought the two newspapers, the Pittsburgh Gazette and the Pittsburgh Press. I memorized this so I could share it with you. We're talking about the monastic contribution to the laity today. Let me give you the figures. I counted them. The Pittsburgh Press is the principal daily paper of the city of Pittsburgh. There were 22, 20, and 26. Under vital statistics, 22 marriage licenses issued for the previous day. There were 22 cases for divorce filed in Pittsburgh for the previous 24 hours. And there were 26 divorces granted. That's our stable United States. Is that something? 22 marriage licenses, 22 divorces applied for, and 26 granted in one day, in one city. Frightening, isn't it? okay, we better do something. Can't go on. You can't have a society on those premises. So that what St. Benedict and for centuries his monks did was to civilize, as we say, Europe. Many of them were nomads, wanderers, vandals, see? Civilized by stabilizing. Civilized by having them live together so men would be satisfied with one wife and remain faithful to her until death. Okay? So much for continuity. I think I told you, didn't I, at one occasion, never learn anything which you don't intend to share. Did I tell you that? Oh, that's a good rule. Never. Never learn anything unless you intend to share it. If you can't foresee how you're going to share it, don't bother. Why clutter the mind? Just more junk that you'll have to throw out and may stand in the way of something else you might want to use. Finally, permanent values. In general, as we know, in the monastic tradition, the world was considered sinful. Well, we don't have to go to the monks to be told the world is sinful, but this is a stress in the monastic tradition. Consequently, there would be a flight from the world of sin. But it was not to run away from human beings. Because if anything, the monasteries were highly populated territories. In fact, I would say in the 7th or 8th century that perhaps the most densely populated sections of Europe were the monasteries. So, the first lesson, the permanent value for everybody. Have no illusion, no illusion about the world being sinful. There are people, God judges their hearts. But we've got to judge from the way they behave. They are just not good for us. So there must be in all, and not merely religious, anyone who wants to live even a good Christian life, there must be withdrawal from certain people. Agreed? Either you withdraw from certain people or you can never achieve, I don't see perfection, you won't even save your souls. And let no one fool you that you're failing in charity by withdrawing from certain people, especially the one from whom you're withdrawing. Don't you love me anymore? Yes, but not the way I used to. And you better believe it. The 900 victims of the Reverend Jones that by now we've all read and heard about, right? They were enamored of a wicked person. Now, God knows how guilty. That's not the point. His ideas were wicked. And sadly, he used, as we know, religion to get people to join him. You had a question, I think.
Yes. What happens in the case of the laity when it's members of one's own family?
Well, I'd say withdrawal nevertheless. Now, there are ways and ways of withdrawing. And of course, there are circumstances at home that make it difficult. But I have more than once counseled people, say young people, the only way you can even protect your virtue is to leave home. You've got to. But then, it is not only withdrawing from people who are sinful. See, sin has a name. Sin is people. Sin is not some dark cloud, you know, over the horizon. Sin is people. And so correspondingly, concentrating on God and heavenly things, that means that monasticism has left for all times the lesson of choosing with what people we're going to associate, whom we're going to live with by preference. And if they use nasty names or criticize us or trick out their psychiatrists to tell us how infantile we are, that we're not strong enough to stand on our own 2 feet, well, you give them the Bronx cheer. You know what the Bronx cheer is? Otherwise known as the Raz.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.